Well, let's jump in. Numbers chapter 14 is where you're going. I do know that we've got some classes in here that aren't normally in here. So you might be, I would assume, and I know it's never really safe to assume because there's new folks in the congregation, new folks who listen online. And so if you are familiar with the story, whether it's because, you know, you weren't in my class, but you know the story of what happens in Numbers chapter 13 with Israel deciding not to go into the promised land, or if you've been in my class, just bear with me as I kind of recap some of it. Obviously, we started this particular study years ago in the book of Genesis, and we saw how God brought Abraham's family down into Egypt to really incubate them and to grow them and to protect them. And he made them a couple promises. He said, I'm going to make a great nation out of you, and I'm going to bring you out, and I'm going to be a God to you. And what he didn't tell them, though, is that after a little while, they'd end up slaves, but they would grow exponentially, and God would favor them, and God would bless them, and that God would eventually meet his promise. 430 years later, he brought him out of Egypt. And that's the story of Exodus. And so Exodus is God bringing Egypt to its knees, really destroying it, freeing the nation of Israel. And then we get to the kind of the end of the book of Exodus. We end up at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is really the kind of the starting point for Moses. When Moses had fled in the beginning of the book of Exodus, he was 40 years old. He fled into Midian, and he met God on Mount Sinai, and God called him to go back into Egypt to bring the children of Israel out. And he told him, he said, a sign for you that you will know that I'm your God is you'll be back at this mountain with these people. And again, he thought it was impossible, but sure enough, at the end of the book, here stands Moses. There's all the people. They meet God on Mount Sinai. I will say this is a gross understatement. It was not without its hiccups. It was not without its road bumps. It was not without its rebellion. And really, it's such a frustrating example to watch Israel, because it seems like every story recorded in the Bible is just one failure after another after another. And so they get to Sinai. The law is given by God there in Sinai, and that's really the book of Leviticus. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Then you get to Numbers, and Numbers is really the journey again. And apparently, this is like a Willie Nelson song, On the Road Again, so I apologize if that was throwing you off in the beginning. Hopefully you're not thinking about that every time you come to church, but either way, basically Numbers is them saying, hey, we spent 11 months at Mount Sinai receiving the law. Now it's time to get on the road again and go into the promised land. And so it takes them, again, everything's kind of a rough estimate. Not everything. We do know some absolute timeline, but it's pretty much a rough estimate from Mount Sinai over through the wilderness of Paran, and they get there. And honestly, it couldn't have taken more than a couple of weeks. We know a couple of months pass, and sure enough, they get there in chapter number 13. They come up with the idea, let's send in spies. It wasn't God's original idea. They say, well, we need to know which way to go and what cities to go in. Well, first of all, that was God's decision anyway. God was going to take them in just like he does 40 years later with Joshua. He takes them through the river. He takes them to the certain cities. And so it never was their place to know how do we get there. They were just worried about what was coming next. So they asked God for permission, and God said, fine, send them in. And Moses tells them, go in there and see if the land is good. See if there are, you know, if there's cities and walls and how many people are there, and is it as God said? And sure enough, they come back and they say, yes, it was just like God said. However, there are giants in the land. And we were like grasshoppers in their sight. And they bring up this idea of giants three times in their complaint. And what happens is these spies come back again. 12 men went to spy on Canaan, 10 were bad, and 2 were good. Caleb and Joshua try to steal the people and say, no, we can do this. They are like bread to us, for us. Where one side of the spies said, we're like grasshoppers to them. They say, they're like bread to us. We can take these guys. If God's for us, there's no way they can stop us. And they try to steal the people. And sure enough, they rebel, and they mourn through the night. We'll kind of pick up on that story in just a little bit, but that's kind of where we're standing right now. There's basically a three-day timeline that happens between Numbers chapter 13 and chapter 14. 3 days transpire, and I'll fill you in on some of that. Now, the significance of Numbers chapter 14 is that it is really the moment in the life of the nation of Israel that will define them, not just only for the rest of this generation, but really for the rest of the nation's biblical history. In fact, when the faithlessness of Israel is referenced in the future of the scripture, they'll come down and reference the events of this chapter. There are psalms written entirely about the faithlessness of God's people. Yea, they turned back and limited the Holy One of Israel. We're going to read that. We're going to read that today, but I've just got too much content in the five verses of chapter 14, so we don't get to it. But that's what it says of this. They turned back and limited God. God wanted to do something great, but they wouldn't do it. Future prophets, when they would rebuke Israel for their faithlessness, they would remind the current populace of what happened in Exodus or Numbers chapter 14 and 13. They remind them of this. In fact, Jesus himself, speaking of the faithlessness of his generation, reminded them that their fathers believed not God and died in the wilderness. And so this is really a defining moment for the entire nation of Israel. The failures of this chapter really cannot be overstated, and what's most important is, worst yet, they cannot be undone. The mistakes of this chapter cannot be reversed. Now, I want to say, as we kind of think about ourselves, praise God that his mercy is present and ever enduring, and it's renewed every day, but we must never be foolish to think that mercy means a complete reversal of God's judgment. We know that his mercy does endure forever, and that his mercies are new for every day, that he'll never leave us or forsake us, and that if we confess our sins, he is faithful and he's just to forgive us our sins. But that doesn't mean that he repeals every shred of his judgment on our disobedience. That doesn't mean crop failure for the foolishness of our own life. So in mercy, and this is certainly the case in chapter 14, in mercy, God certainly, I wouldn't say softens, he chooses to offer a more gracious execution of judgment. And we studied this last week. And so those who weren't in my class, you can always go back and listen online last week. Last week, we saw that God said, I'm going to kill them all as one man. And Moses, I'm going to start over with you. And Moses says, please, Lord, the nations of the world are going to see what happens here. And they're not going to know about the faithlessness of Israel. They're going to think you couldn't bring them in and you killed them here for that. And so God decides to be gracious and not kill them all as one man, but rather let them die in the wilderness. And so he is gracious. He allows them to reap in a more gentle way, but ultimately, there is judgment. And so the idea of this whole chapter and this whole study is that while God's grace is present and while his mercy is very real, there are some things that cannot be undone. And again, the men asked me for the title this evening, and I said, irreversible mistakes, something along those lines. You make mistakes in life, and I have made mistakes in life that cannot be erased. Sure, there's mercy available, but a lot of times the scars don't go away, and we're going to see that in really high definition. So some brief review. Like I told you, those spies come back. Caleb and Joshua try to steal the people. The people still get worked up. They cry through the night. They mourn through the night that really God, and this is chapter 13, that God had misrepresented to them. They were upset that God expected them to have to fight giants. And again, God said he was going to do all the heavy lifting, but they feel in some respects that they have been lied to, if you can say it. That seems a little rich. But anyway, they feel like it's been misrepresented, and Moses brought us out here, and really we were never going to be able to take that promised land. And so they decide in the morning. So that's day one. The spies come back, and they work up the people. They cry through the night from day one to day two. Day two, they wake up, and their mourning turns to rage, really. Their mourning turns to just absolute fury. They decide for themselves, well, we're going to make us captains, and we're going to go back into Egypt, and we're going to go all the way back there. But before we leave, we have to kill this man, Moses. And as they take up rocks to stone Moses, God shows up behind them and pronounces his judgment on them. And that again is where God says they're all going to die as one man, but God offers them mercy through Moses' petition. And what's absolutely crazy about the rest of this chapter, that's all chapter 14. What's absolutely crazy is about the rest of this chapter is what happens in those final five verses. Israel expects the penalty of their sin to be entirely erased. We just read it in closing last week. We just said, hey, I'm gonna read this to you, but I want you to go home with it. But really, from verse 40 through verse 45 are some of the most incomprehensible kind of looks into the heart of Israel. In fact, it's so incredibly, and I try not to use this word often, especially in the pulpit, but I don't know of another word. It's so incredibly stupid. The decisions that they make and the expectations that they have in those final four five verses, so unfathomably arrogant and ignorant. It makes me wonder, I was telling my wife this, are we really them? I mean, them is pretty awful. It's really, really, really hard to watch the foolishness, again, I don't know if there's another word, stupidity of what happens in these final four verses and think, are we really that foolish? I don't think maybe I would ever do that, right? And yet, unfortunately, as we examine it tonight, and I've examined my own heart, I think we're going to have to say with honest hearts that we've done some of this. I'll say this again at the end. The arrogance on them looks disgusting. On us, it feels reasonable. Like, in their context, we're like, wow, how could they ever do that? And then by the time we end tonight, I'm going to give you some illustrations of maybe things that we would do. And while to us, it looks foolish over there, and yet in our lives, we say, yeah, but this is different. And yet it's the same presumptuous relationship. It's the same rebellious actions. And so now I hope we've never done on the scale that they are doing in this particular setting. But I think if we're going to be honest, we're going to find ourselves in the passage tonight. And so we're going to pick up in verse number 39, just to kind of catch up with what we kind of tie it to last week's study in the previous verses, Numbers 14:39. It says, "And Moses told these sayings unto all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly." Now, this is the second time, right? So day one, Israel, the spies come back. They tell them of the land. And yes, it's exactly as God said, but there's giants there. And the people weep through the night, feeling like they're the victims. God misrepresented this. And we had all these high hopes about the promised land. And now there's giants there. And we can't go over there. I know God said he could and that he would, but we don't believe him. And so he misrepresented. And so they cry through the night. Again, day two, they want to take up arms and kill Moses. God shows up, pronounces judgment on them, says they're going to die all as one man. Moses beseeches the Lord, and God says, okay, they're going to die in the wilderness. And he brings the message to these people. That's verse 39. And it says, and the people mourned greatly. So finally, they're weeping over their own iniquities. But again, you get to verse 40, and it's a completely different set of people, it feels like. It's like their brain fell out. Verse number 40. And they rose up early in the morning. Again, so we know what day it is. We're on day three. Day one, spies. Day two, let's kill Moses, okay? Day three, they wake up. They've cried. They evidently slept through the night, it appears. And then they wake up. And notice what it says. And they arose early in the morning and got them up into the top of the mountain, saying, lo, we be here. And we will go up unto the place which the Lord hath promised, for we have sinned. Now, I know that seems like just one verse and like we could just keep moving, but there is so much in the heart of man recorded in this one single verse. Let me try to paint you an emotional picture of these people, right? 2 days ago, their hearts are broken. God has lied. Moses has misrepresented. Their promised home is impossible. They're weeping. They're mourning. They're murderously mad. Some of the men figure out the exit plan. Let's make captains. Let's go back. And I know we're kind of reviewing the story because, again, I want you to see the whole, like, three-day picture of their heart. And so they gather to kill the people, and now they get back to this idea over here, and they're like, okay, yeah, I know that we said we were going to kill you, Moses, and I know that God said no, that we can't go in, but we're here now, and let's go ahead and go into the promised land. And as I think about this, all of the last 3 days, to me, I can't help but think how incredibly absent they are from thinking of God. It's like at no point in the 3 days that this happens, from the time they sent spies to the time that they're getting ready to go up and they say, all right, God, Moses, go tell God we're going to go into the promised land. And it's like at no point did they ever acknowledge what they had already seen. And there's no remembrance of what God was on the mountain. They had seen his pillar of cloud and his pillar of fire. They had heard his thunderings at Mount Sinai. The elders of the tribes of Israel had seen some kind of manifestation of God. Sapphire looked like the stars. If you were in our study, we saw that. Never mind what he did at the Red Sea. But now, it's in the context of day two. It's us versus Moses. Let's kill Caleb. Let's kill Joshua. Let's kill Aaron. And until God shows up, they're going to do it. But when God shows up, they drop their rocks, right? The people mourn, they go back to their tent, they fall asleep, and the very next morning they rise and they weigh their options. So follow me here. They weigh their options day three. They look out and say, okay, ooh, yesterday was tough. We almost killed Moses, we almost killed Aaron, almost killed Caleb and Joshua, but God said we couldn't go. So let's weigh our options. Either one, we can die in the wilderness, or two, we can trust God and go into the promised land. Now let me ask you a question. Are these options even on the table anymore? The answer is no. And it's showing you the mindset of these people. They wake up with no remorse and they say, okay, fine. After weighing their options, they go to Moses and say, okay, Moses, let's get this show on the road. Let's do this again. And really, to see the heart of the nation of Israel, you need look no further than the first word they say. Would you look at it midway through verse 39? It's two letters long. Lo. Lo, we be here and we'll go up into the place which the Lord hath promised, for we have sinned. You know what the word lo means? It means look. Now, Let me put it in your context. Have you ever had an argument with your spouse? Never, right? I haven't either, never. If you've ever had an argument, okay, nobody wants to own that. Okay, we'll teach on lying soon. If you've ever had an argument with your spouse, and maybe let's say it's unresolved and you break for a minute and you come back and one partner comes to the other and says, look, okay, that's not the right way to start the conversation, right? So really, that's what just happened. Day one, oh, we can't do it. Day two, we're going to kill him. Day three, look, Moses, fine. We're ready. I know we tried to kill you yesterday, but we're here now. We know we sinned. We know we messed up. But good news is, Moses, we've changed our mind. We're here right now. And Israel has, in some respects, repented of what they did. So look, Moses, it's all good, right? It's all good. We go get God and let him know that we're getting on board. I'm sure God's going to be excited that we're ready to go in the promised land. I know we were rebellious. I know we tried to kill you, but just go ahead and tell God that we're ready to go now, and I'm sure he'll accept our offer. There is so much presumptuous arrogance represented in that phrase. They just assume, hey, he's been merciful before. He'll be merciful this time. I mean, he's offered us grace before. He'll offer us grace. We've complained before. We've done this whole thing before. I mean, we came through the wilderness, right? And we tempted him in Egypt and didn't believe him there, and yet he was still gracious to us. We tempted him at Sinai even. In fact, we had we built a golden altar and had an illicit drunken party in the absence of Moses. And you know what? He forgave us, and so why would this time be any different? And so they wake up, and they gather their men to war, and they've decided it's time to obey. Moses, let's go get God. Can you just let him know we've changed our mind and we're ready to go now? It's not even like, and here's what bothers me. It's not even like they asked Moses, can you go entreat the Lord for us? It's not even like they showed up and said, Moses, we have sinned. Please go ask God for mercy. They just show up and say, look, Moses, lo, Moses, we be here. We're ready to go. There's such an absence of genuine remorse. As if they themselves get to call the shots. Like, all right, it's time to go. Right now, Moses, go get him. It's morning. Let's get this show on the road. We're ready to go. Go get God. It's time now. And what's saddest and most telling about the shallow relationship that Israel has with God in this moment is that they truly believe that their repentance is acceptable before God. Because you're going to see at the end of the story, God's going to tell them no. It's the very next verse. And they're going to go anyway. Because they think, no, God, sure, but he needs to get on board. So if he doesn't, we're just going to go anyway. And I want you to notice the response that we find through Moses, or rather from God through Moses. And it's perhaps one of the most opposite passages really in all the scripture. It completely flips and unravels the promises and assurances that we've been hearing since we left Egypt. Really, in Exodus, these promises were made. Go up. I will be with you. I will drive them out. All the way through Leviticus and the last 14 chapters, we've been hearing these same thing. And really in this next couple verses, it's going to get flipped completely on their head. Where God would say, the Lord is with you, you will prosper, you'll drive out your adversaries, possess it at once, I'll deliver you from the sword. And the next set of verses are completely antithetical. They are the complete opposite of what God has been telling them for 2.5 books. Notice what he says. So they say, Moses, great news, look, we're going in. And Moses said, wherefore do ye now transgress the commandment of the Lord? You're doing it again, is what he says. You're doing it again. You disobeyed God last time, and now you think and then he said, okay, here's the law, here's the rule, here's the expectation, here's judgment, and you say, well, that's not good enough, we're going to do it our own way. They don't get it, but they're still rebelling. They think, and I don't know if they think this, maybe they think they're acting in courage. Maybe they think they're acting in faith. Really, I think it's just in their own self-interest because, man, we can go back and die in the wilderness. We can't even go back to Egypt. God promised us we'd die by the way of the Red Sea. And now we have the option of going in, and it's not even that they feel bad. It's that they know they've lost what they set out for, and they're serving their own self-interest. It's not that they're remorseful. It's not that they feel guilty. Again, you can see it by the fact that they just say, hey, Moses, go get God. We're going to do this thing. And Moses says, you're doing it again. You're disobeying the commandments of God. And notice what he says, but it shall not prosper. That's the opposite of everything they've been told for the last 2.5 books. You will prosper. You will possess the land. I will take care of you. And again, what was once an unshakable promise of God in that they would own this land, it's now guaranteed that they would not succeed at all. Continue, verse number 42. Go not up. This was their marching order since Exodus. This was their marching order since Egypt. Go up. In fact, last chapter, Caleb said, go up at once. It's time right now. And Moses says, don't go up, for the Lord is not among you. And listen, for the, like I said, the last 2.5 books, we've heard, we've seen that God was with them. Think about it. Everything we've seen, kind of tangible and physical, has been a manifestation of this reality that God was with them. The pillar of cloud was a sign that God was with them. The pillar of fire, the tabernacle itself was a sign that God dwelt among his people. The tabernacle of meetings, the tabernacle of congregation, where God would be with them. The ark was a symbol that God would be with them. The whole sacrificial system was about God being with them. The whole red light, green light thing that we talked about, all the trumpets, it was all about God being with them. And here in this, again, antithetical passage, Moses says, no, don't go up. The Lord is not with you. And notice what he says at the end of verse number 42, that ye be not smitten before your enemies. These enemies, and he'll list two of them, those two enemies were listed as enemies they would destroy in previous passages. But now he says the perfect opposite. If you go up this hill, if you go to this fight, you will lose. Verse number 43. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you. We already knew they were there. This was part of the promise since Exodus. The Amalekites and the Canaanites, they were always a part of this process. They were always a part of God delivering the nation of Israel. But he says, for the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and ye shall fall by the sword. Every promise, not I can't say every promise, but all of the relevant promises of entering the promised land, all of them are unraveling before their eyes. One by one, God's saying, no, that one's done. No, that one's done. No, that one's done. He's really making sure they're clear on the terms. Continue in verse 43. Because you are turned away from the Lord, therefore the Lord will not be with you. So he's telling them, he says, Israel, you don't have any options. You don't get to show up and throw God a bone. You don't get to, there's no offer on the table for you to consider. You can't graciously accept God's offer and do him any favors. God is done. The judgment is past. You will die. Your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. Now, you would think, right? You would think they cannot possibly be so absolutely foolish that after hearing in such uncertain, or forgive me, in such certain, absolutely crystal clear terms, that they would continue with this mission. But the next three words are just so unbelievable. Look at it. Verse 44. But they presumed. Presumed, I'll give you a better definition in a little bit when I get to it in my notes, but essentially presumed means to assume with pride and confidence that something that is very uncertain is sure. You're presuming it. You're kind of assuming it in this presumptuous manner. And so, but they presumed to go up unto the hilltop. I mean, every parent in here understands the frustration of this verse. Don't touch that item. And what does the child do? Touches the item. Well, here's the army of Israel, the army of God. Again, just the day earlier, tried to kill Moses. Show up this morning and, hey, great news, Moses. Go get God. We're on. No, you're not. God's done. The judgment's been pronounced. You don't get to go up. God's not going with you. And they presume to go up into the hilltop. And notice what absolute specificity God includes in the rest of verse 44. Nevertheless, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and Moses departed not out of the camp. You notice what he said? He said, God didn't go with them. Moses didn't go with them. The ark didn't go with them. So what in the world are they thinking? And again, it shows you how absolutely shallow their relationship with God truly was. Do you remember back at the foot of Mount Sinai, the kind of God they asked Aaron for? If you weren't in our study, I'll remind you. When they gave Aaron the gold, they said, we want you to make us a god that will bring us into the promised land. Essentially, they said, we don't know what happened to Moses up there. He's been gone for 40 days. And so, Aaron, make us a God who can give us the blessings of God without all the rules that Moses had. Without all the expectations of the God up there on the mountain, get us a God that can get us into the promised land. And really, it seems really clear that not a lot has changed since then. since then. They know God isn't with them. They can see, undoubtedly, as they're traveling up this mountain to slaughter, you'll see, as they're traveling up this mountain, they for sure could see the cloud of God. They could see the tabernacle, no doubt. Moses down there. God didn't go with them. And they're promised that this is not going to work. Yet they continue on anyway. And think with me, though, why? They got two options, right? We're going to die in the wilderness, and the land we've been promised is just over the hill. I know God said he's not going to bless, but maybe we could take it. Whereas again, with God, they weren't willing to take it. They were scared, but now they're saying, well, we don't want to go that way, so we'll go this way without God. And they took it upon themselves in verse 45. Then the Amalekites came down, and the Canaanites, the exact same people that Moses just talked about, which dwelt in that hill, and smote them and discomfited them, even unto Hormah. Now that word Hormah, it's named, most people would agree, there's two great slaughters that happen at this city, this being the first one, and it means destruction. And so they go up and they set up to go fight. They don't even make it all the way up the hill. The people who live in that country come down and they begin to fight and they lose and they die and they flee and they chased and they're slaughtered. And for all of their confidence and all of their arrogance and all of their presumption, God was 100% right. They did not get to call the shots. They would turn and go by the way of the Red Sea, whether they wanted to or not. Their carcasses would inevitably fall in that wilderness. Their chance into the promised land was no more. Their children would indeed inherit it. Their children they couldn't believe could do it. Their children they said would be prey. Their wives would be taken. Their children would be prey. Therefore, we won't go over into the promised land. And God says, no, I'm going to make your children the conquerors you never were. And so let's move into application and let's take the mirror and look. Again, I'm looking at that mirror thinking, no way that's us, right? That's so dumb. That's really arrogant. That's super, super foolish. We could never be there. But as I mentioned earlier in this story, it's hard to see in us in this story because we think, well, we're not that foolish. We would never. But again, I think if we'll pay close attention, there are a lot of parallels in the way that we presumptuously think. That's what we're going to focus on tonight. I hope this doesn't describe you in every facet, but I'm sure at one point in your life, as with mine, there are times that we have behaved in similar fashion to the Lord. And so I'm going to show you seven presumptuous ways of thinking that are displayed in this particular biblical account that may apply to us. So number one, we make presumptuous mistakes when we think that all of our decisions are reversible. Now, let me remind you of what Israel had said. We're not able to go. Would to God we died in the wilderness. Let us make a captain and go back to Egypt. Let's stone Moses, Aaron, Caleb, and Joshua before we go. They made their decision that we would rather die over there. And here's what I want to point out to you. That decision wasn't reversible. They couldn't just show up and say, okay, hit the reset button, Lord. Moses, look, we're here and it's good and we can just start this whole thing over again. No, the decision was settled. It was final. It could not be repaired. It could not be undone. It could not be erased and forgotten. And in our own presumptuous foolishness, we say things like, she'll forgive me. It was just one time. I can fix this when it's over. I can make it right. I'll confess it later. I can undo the damage. It's not that bad. My parents won't find out. It just happened once. I can handle this. And the matter of the fact is, while there is, thank God, grace for sin, there are scars and brokenness from the decisions we make that cannot be reversed. And again, I've talked about this, and I think it's an excellent illustration, and I don't mean to belabor the fact, but it's probably new for some of you, but years ago, we were driving in the car, and I think it was my daughter. She had a balloon. She was playing with somebody who had given it to her, and she popped it. And my kids know if they break something that I can probably fix it, right? If they break a toy, I've got some glue, and I got, you know, some things I can try to help with this, and this balloon popped, and she said, Daddy, fix it. And I turned around, and I looked. There's just nothing you can do. I mean, that's gone. I mean, you tear the bottom of your shoe off, I can glue it back together. You know, you break a wooden toy, maybe I can nail it back together. But there are some things that if you break, nobody can put it back together. And Israel would be defined for the rest of its history by this foolish moment. And we fail to recognize that in our own mistakes, often do determine the rest of our lives. And again, I know that there are mistakes represented in this room, and so I'll try to be gracious, so I won't necessarily go into detail. But sin has consequences, and many times those consequences are irreversible. Sometimes that relationship can't be restored. Sometimes that purity can't be put back together. Sometimes that decision cannot be undone. And it would be foolish for us to assume like, I'll just wake up tomorrow and start over, right? I mean, we'll just start over with God, and we'll just start over with my spouse, and I'll just start over as a parent, and, you know, I just live the rest of my young life, and we'll just pretend like that never happened. But we don't live in a video game where you just respawn. You can't just restart your purity. You can't just restart your marriage oftentimes. There are decisions, and there are, I don't even call them mistakes, because a mistake's like, oh man, I got 2% when I meant to buy whole milk. Yeah, that's a mistake. You know, you see athletes do it, right? They'll call it the mistake of adultery. And what did they do? They just bought her a bigger ring and we just started over. I don't think that really works that way. There are decisions and mistakes that cannot be reversed. So we make presumptuous mistakes, number one, when we think that everything can be fixed. Number two, we make a presumptuous mistake when we think we always have options. Options. And this is one of the reasons I wanted the teenagers in this particular meeting. We think, well, I can do it my way, or I can do it God's way, or I can do it my way, then I can do it God's way. And I hear that a lot. Because I still love him, you know. I mean, I don't want to totally walk away from God, but I got this girlfriend, or I got this job opportunity, or I got this thing I want to do. And you know what? I'll be back because I've got options. I get to choose. That's exactly what happens with Israel. They show up and say, well, we got two options. No, you don't. You already made your decision. There is no option where Moses goes and says, all right, high five, God, let's do this. We're going in. That is not on the table. That option is not there. Has it ever occurred to you that perhaps God removes certain options off the table? Happily ever after may not still be on the table after you sow your wild oats and decide to come back. If you live lasciviously and expect to someday marry a person who fears God and live under his blessings, maybe that option is not on the table. And I know that God can restore and do all kinds of things. I'm just suggesting that we're foolish when we think, yeah, I can do it his way, or I can do it my way, or what's most popular, I'll go do it my way, then I'll do it his way. The fullness of God's blessings might just be out of reach. That perfect will of God that he created you for, you can disqualify yourselves. And listen, I'll get the idea. Well, I'll get right with God, you know, when it's my time. I'll go have fun. I'll sow my wild oats. I'll meet a girl. We'll fornicate. We'll have a kid. We'll get married. And then we'll just come back into church. Maybe. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. And we're presumptuous when we think, well, yeah, but, you know, Pastor, I'm not dumb. There's a lot of couples in our church, you know, who didn't do it right, and God's blessing them, you know. Like, my parents did it that way. You know, my parents were in the military, or my parents were, you know, teenagers, and all this stuff. And yeah, your parents were lost, right? And in the days of their ignorance, God winked at, and then mom and dad got saved, and yeah, they got saved with baggage, and God began to bless them. But here's the difference between you and your parents, or you and the person you're looking at in church saying, yeah, but I know they had it messed, and God blessed them. Here's the difference. You know better. Israel knew better. The Canaanites didn't know better. Israel knew better. They knew that God's plan was for them to obey, and yet they chose not to. And yes, God gave grace to your parents and made them new creatures and gave them a life that is blessed. And you look at it and say, that's awesome. But they started way over here, and so I'm saved, and I can go run over here and then come back. Again, when we look at Israel, we think, what's the word? Stupidity. And I don't mean to be condescending. There's just not a better word for it. That you think, well, you know, it's the third day, and I know we tried to kill you, Moses, but high five, man, we're ready. No, there's no options on the table. You don't get to call those shots. Presumptuously, we think everything's reversible. Presumptuously, we think, well, we've always got options. Presumptuously, we think we always have time. We always have time. Would you jump back? You're still there. Numbers 14, verse 25. Numbers chapter 14, verse 25. I want to focus in on that idea of time. The phrase on the morrow. This is on day two, God's talking about what happens on the morrow in verse 25. So on day three. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites dwell in the valley. Tomorrow, turn you and get you into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. You catch that? On day two, God said on day three, when you wake up, go out there to die. I mean, there's no two ways to split that hair. This is what he said. Tomorrow, go by the way of the Red Sea. You're not going to make it all the way back into Egypt, but you're going to go the way you came back, and you're going to wander out there for 40 years till the faithless generation dies. Tomorrow, go do that. Jump down to verse number 40. Contrast that with Israel's plans for tomorrow. Verse 40. And they rose up early in the morning on that morrow and got them up to the top of the mountain, saying, lo, we be here, and we will go into the place which the Lord hath promised. Right? God still promised us that. For we have sinned. They said, hey, let's sleep on it. You know, I know God said tomorrow we got to go and start our journey of death. But, you know, we've got time and we'll make our decisions. We've got time. Except they didn't. They didn't. When they showed up on the morrow and said, okay, let's go in. God said, no, I already told you what to do today. I already told you where your plans would be. Listen to this idea. And I don't mean this to be, it's a quote. But listen, today's plans were settled in yesterday's decisions. Okay? Today's reality, today's will for your life, today's blessings, in many cases, were settled in yesterday's decisions. So on the morrow, okay, well, no, let's go do this. And God says, no, yesterday decided what today holds. Yesterday decided your faithlessness would be punished by God. And listen, they didn't have the luxury of making the call to get right tomorrow. And just like them, we make the foolishness of thinking, well, I'll get it right tomorrow. I got time. It's not that big of a deal. When I get to it, I'll get to it. When I get to the will of God, I'll get to it. I know God's calling me to this, but I got time. I'll get to it when I get to it. And I would just submit to you that the blessings of tomorrow are determined by the obedience in many cases of today. Number four, presumptuously, we think it's always our decision to make. We saw a little bit of this, right? The idea, well, I can reverse it. I still got time. I still got options. And honestly, it's my decision to make. But that's not what happened in our story. They didn't get to just show up and tell Moses, all right, it's our decision. Moses, go tell God, let's go in there. Let's go back. It's time for me to get back into the will of God. It's my decision. We're choosing to obey. And man, I have seen this so many times. Young people who leave God and say, yeah, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I'll show up and I'll come around and church people will be excited to see me. I'll slip right back into my role, start serving again. It'll be just like old times. So hey, I can be free anytime I want from the sin I'm choosing right now. You know what? It'll take a couple years, but I'll be back. I got time. I'm not a slave. I'm not trapped. I can walk away anytime I want. It's my decision. You know, when I don't want this girl anymore, I'll come back to the will of God. When I don't want this sin anymore, I'll come back to the will of God. And the problem is, that's not what the Bible teaches us with sin. Romans chapter 6, verse 16, a verse that every one of us should be familiar with, and we've read it. Romans 6, 16 says, know ye not that to whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are. When you decide to be a slave of someone, you're now a slave. So when you say, all right, I want to be a servant, lock me up. But then I want to leave. Then I want to leave. No. What know ye not? You get this, right? He says, know you not. That's what he's saying. You understand that to whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom you obey, whether of sin unto death, or of obedience unto righteousness. So you submit yourself to God and you say, Lord, I'm yours. Well, that means I don't get to leave. That means I gotta, okay, you want me in the promised land? Boy, that seems scary, and there's giants over there, but I gotta go, because I'm a servant. But here they decide, no, servant unto sin and death. And we got time, okay, I know we decided this on day two, but we're ready on day three. And God says, no, you're a servant over here. And I wish it wasn't the picture of our human nature, because again, it's disgusting and it's foolish, and yet we do that. We decide, well, just for a little bit, we're going to take our family and we're going to do these things that God's very clearly against. But we'll be back. We're going to misprioritize our life. You know, I know it's just, and again, yeah, this can take so many forms, right? Just pick this. Just kind of let me give you a template. Here's God, his will, and his commands. Here's us, ourself, and what would be opposite of God's commands. So that could take anything from the form of fornication to sports, to be honest with you. And we say, hey, I know God's plan is for me here, but just for a minute, I'm just going to slip over here, but I'll be back. And we're outside of the will of God. Now, I'm not suggesting if you skip church on Sunday for a baseball championship that your whole family is going to end up under a bridge and addicted to drugs. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that what know ye not, that to whom you render yourself servants to obey his servants you are, whether to God or whether to sin, The idea is, it's not always our decision to make. We think it is. We think we can just show up and say, all right, God, throw me back in the line. Oftentimes it doesn't happen that way. Number five, we bank on the fact that God's mercy will absolve all of our failures. Look at verse number 44 of chapter 14. It says, but they presumed. Here's a better definition. I kind of paraphrased it, but the word presumed means this. Supposed or taken to be true or entitled to belief without positive proof. So yeah, I'm sure of it. I've got no proof of it, but I'm sure of it. To be lifted up with false confidence or pride. And here's what they presumed. I mean, he's forgiven us before. Yeah, we've messed up before. He's allowed grace, and this time shouldn't be any different. We do this all the time, Lord. I mean, we should be fine, right? It'll all work out. And we say these same things, like, Lord, you know, it'll all work out. It always has and it always will. You know, I'm just kind of going my own way, and we know that all things work together for good, right? And we think, it'll all be good. God's going to take care of us. You know, I know we totally disobeyed, but we'll still get the promised land. I know we've totally disobeyed God when it comes to parenting, but my children will be victorious. Again, all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are the called according to his purpose. Everything works together for good to those that are searching and seeking and following after God. And again, I know I've used the word stupid a few times. I'm going to use it, I hope, just one more time. But I've said this before. I think it's a hilarious quote because I think it's very true. That people say everything happens for a reason. That's true. And sometimes that reason is you're dumb and you deserved it. Right? Sometimes that reason is you made a decision and bad things happened. It's so frustrating to me when people are like, this is just God's will. Yeah, it's called judgment. This is just life and, you know, God's got a plan. Yeah, part of that plan might be you having to get your heart right and you having to walk through some of that. Listen, part of that working is maybe delivering such an one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit might be saved. So you can't just blame everything and say, I'll be fine. God will take care of it. I can do what I want. And God, he's always been super gracious, and he will always be. But don't take this foolish, like, God's in heaven, you know, a battered spouse, just waiting on us to show back up. Listen, the father waited for the prodigal. And the father welcomed the prodigal son home, and he put a ring on his hand and a robe on his back and food in his belly, and he took him in, and that son owned nothing. You ever thought about that part of the story? Everything else left there belonged to the other kid. He sold all his possession. So sure, he's got a home, and he's got a warm bed, and he's got food, but he doesn't own any of that kingdom now. And so this idea that, yes, God will welcome us home. He will. He always will. He's so good. He's so merciful. But a lot of times we come home with baggage and brokenness that we're going to bear for the rest of our life. And this decision will define Israel for the rest of its life, for the rest of the nation of history's life. This will be the turning point that is referenced of them. We're almost done. Number one, we make presumptuous mistakes when we think we can reverse everything. When we think we have options, we think we have time. We think the decision is always ours to make. We think that mercy of God will always rescue us. Presumptuously, just like Israel, we excuse ourselves from the pronounced judgments of God on our sin as if they do not apply to us. We think I think about their story. Think about their story. Israel says, well, you know, we know God said we're going to die. We know God said that we couldn't go over, but we're ready now. And so we know God said it, but he doesn't actually mean it, and we'll be exempt from that. Even beyond that, Moses says no. He says, no, the ark isn't going to go. God's presence doesn't go. Moses doesn't go. They're reminded again they'll die, and what do? They got up and said, sure, and they presumed that they could do it anyway. They thought that they would be the exception. And we do this a lot. I know the Bible says a companion of fools would be destroyed, but, you know, that's not me. That's not talking about me. I'm not talking about my kids and the influence I allow in their life. That's talking about other people. Okay. You know, fornication is a sin against your own flesh and it destroys you. But yeah, that's not me. I can look at what I want and do what I want. You know, we've got this figured out. Rebellion secures the judgment of God. I'll be the exception. I know that every other young person that went out and did their own thing, God judged them, but it won't happen to me. God says you can't have his blessings without his obedience. Yeah, but I can and I will. I'll go take that hill. I'll get it done. The way of the transgressor is hard. Yeah, no. Living in church is hard. And not my parents not letting me have this phone and not letting me do this. That's hard. I'm going to go do my own thing, and that's going to be easier. No, God said that way is harder. He said climbing up that mountain will result in your death today. Sure, your judgment is hard, and you'll die within the next 40 years in the wilderness. But you go up there today, you'll die today. And the judgment of God, they were not exempt from it. You know, I think about that verse. The Bible says, when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin when it is finished. I meant to mention this when we talked about the decision is ours. A lot of times we choose the sin and sin chooses when it's done. We pick this and we think, I'll just dabble in it a little bit. And then all of a sudden it's addiction. And all of a sudden it's the definition of our life. And all of a sudden we are not what we once were. And we think, I could have walked away at any time. But know you not that to whom you render yourself servants to obey is servants you are? You're a slave. And sin decides when it is finished, it bringeth forth death. Along those same lines, I want you to think number 7 as we finish. We think sometimes we can prove God wrong. We think the principles of God don't apply to us. And then, even as foolish as Israel was, we think we can prove God wrong. In spite of being told in no uncertain terms that they would go out and that they would die, they still chose to go and do it. But again, how do we apply this to our hearts? I've seen it. I've heard it. I'm going to be fine. I'll be back. But God said in Galatians 6:7, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. I'm going to be fine. No, you're not. God said you won't be. God said there's judgment. God said that there's punishment. God said that he desires for you to avoid all of this. And you think, no. I'll set out. I'll make my way. I'll get rich. I'll be happy. I'll do my own thing. And sure, you may have the biggest bank account of any person in your immediate family or anybody you ever knew here at church. And you may succeed by that metric. But find a person who ever climbed that ladder who knew that God was supposed to be filling them who was ever happy. I'll name one. His name was Solomon. The richest, most powerful man in the world who tried everything any of us think would make us happy. Money, he tried it. Music, he tried it. Women, he tried it. Gardening, he tried it. Everything. Houses. Anything his flesh wanted, he kept not from himself. And yet we all know that life was empty and he hated it. Why? Because he had forsaken God. And he ends that book of Ecclesiastes, the experience of the wisest man who had ever walked the earth outside of Jesus, who kept his wisdom even in his rebellion so that he could write a first-person account of what it's like to live for self. And he gets to the end of his book and he says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Let us fear God and keep his commandments, for it's the whole duty of man. Even in all of his power, wealth, wisdom, everything you and I will never be able to have as much of as he does, he still says, I couldn't prove God wrong. I was happier with him. I was happier when I was in God's will. And like I said, this is why I hate looking in this mirror, because this arrogance is disgusting on them. Like, oh, you guys are so foolish. And yet oftentimes it's reasonable for us. I mean, I would never climb the hill with the Amalekites and the Canaanites at the top of it. I know that's destruction. But you'll play with fire and look at things you know you shouldn't. You'll develop relationships in the office with people you know you shouldn't. You'll allow things in your kids' lives that you know you absolutely shouldn't. And it's the same concept. I know God said this. However, I got some things figured out. We make presumptuous mistakes in our thinking, number one, and we'll pray after this. We think we can reverse everything. We think we always have options. We always have time. It'll be our decision to make, and when I want to, I can come back. That's a mistake. We think the mercy of God will rescue us from whatever we put ourselves in. We excuse ourselves from the guarantees of Scripture, and sometimes we even think we can prove God wrong. Let's pray.